By 49 BC, he and Pompey with their legions, he from the west and Pompey from the east, were fighting openly for predominance in the Roman state. He'd broken the law by bringing his legions across the Rubicon, which was the boundary between his command and Italy proper. At the Battle of Pharsalus in Thessaly in 48 BC, Pompey was routed, and, fleeing to Egypt, was murdered, leaving Caesar more master of the Roman world than ever Sulla had been. He was then created dictator for 10 years in 46 BC, and early in 45 BC he was made dictator for life. This was monarchy, if not hereditary monarchy. It was at least electoral life monarchy. It was unlimited opportunity to do his best for the world. And by the spirit and quality of his use of this dictatorial power during these 4 years, we're bound to judge him. A certain reorganization of local administration he effected, and he seems to have taken up what was a fairly obvious necessity of the times, a project for the restoration of the two murdered seaports of Corinth and Carthage, whose destruction had wrecked the sea life of the Mediterranean. But much more evident was the influence of Cleopatra and Egypt upon his mind. Like Alexander before him, his head seems to have been turned by the king-god tradition, assisted no doubt in his case by the adulation of that charming hereditary goddess, Cleopatra. We find evidence of exactly that same conflict upon the score of divine pretensions between him and his personal friends that we have already recorded in the case of Alexander. So far as the Hellenized East was concerned, the paying of divine honors to rulers was a familiar idea, but it was still repulsive to the lingering Arianism of Rome. Antony, who had been his second in command at Pharsalus, was one of the chief of his flatterers. Plutarch describes a scene at the public games in which Antony tried to force a crown upon Caesar, which Caesar, after a little coyness, and in face of the manifested displeasure of the crowd, refused. But he had adopted the ivory scepter and throne, which were the traditional insignia of the ancient kings of Rome. His image was carried amidst that of the gods in the opening pomp of the arena, and his statue was set up in a temple with an inscription, "To the unconquerable God." Priests even were appointed for his godhead. These things are not the symptoms of great-mindedness, but of a common man's megalomania. Caesar's record of vulgar scheming for the tawdriest mockeries of personal worship is a silly and shameful record. It's incompatible with the idea that he was a wise and wonderful superman, setting the world to rights. Finally, in 44 BC, he was assassinated by a group of his own friends and supporters to whom these divine aspirations had become intolerable. He was beset in the Senate and stabbed in 23 places, dying at the foot of the statue of his fallen rival, Pompey the Great. The scene marks the complete demoralization of the old Roman governing body. Brutus, the ringleader of the murderers, would have addressed the senators, but confronted by this crisis, they were scuttling off in every direction. For the best part of a day, Rome didn't know what to make of this event. The murderers marched about with their bloody weapons through an undecided city, with no one gainsaying them and only a few joining them. Then public opinion turned against them. Some of their houses were attacked, and they had to hide and fly for their lives. Sixth, but the trend of things was overwhelmingly towards monarchy. For 13 years more, the struggle of personalities went on. One single man is to be noted as inspired by broad ideas and an ambition not entirely egoistic, Cicero. He was a man of modest origin whose eloquence and literary power had won him a prominent place in the Senate. He was a little tainted by the abusive tradition of Demosthenes. Nevertheless, he stands out, a noble and pathetically ineffective figure, pleading with the now utterly degenerate, base and cowardly Senate for the high ideals of the Republic. He was a writer of great care and distinction, and the orations and private letters he's left us make him one of the most real and living figures of this period to the modern reader. He was proscribed and killed in 43 BC, the year after the murder of Julius Caesar, and his head and hands were nailed up in the Roman Forum. Octavian, who became at last the monarch of Rome, seems to have made an effort to save Cicero. That murder was certainly not his crime. Here we can't trace out the tangle of alliances and betrayals that ended in the ascendancy of this Octavian, the adopted heir of Julius Caesar. The fate of the chief figures is interwoven with that of Cleopatra. After the death of Caesar, she set herself to capture the emotions and vanity of Antony, a much younger man than Caesar, with whom she was probably already acquainted. For a time, Octavian and Antony and a third figure, Lepidus, divided the Roman world just as Caesar and Pompey had divided it before their final conflict. Octavian took the hardier west and consolidated his power. Antony had the more gorgeous east and Cleopatra. To Lepidus fell that picked bone Carthaginian Africa. He seems to have been a good man of good traditions, set upon the restoration of Carthage rather than upon wealth or personal vanities. The mind of Antony succumbed to those same ancient ideas of divine kingship that had already proved too much for the mental equilibrium of Julius Caesar. In the company of Cleopatra, he gave himself up to love, amusements, and a dream of sensuous glory, until Octavian felt that the time was ripe to end these two Egyptian divinities. In 32 BC, Octavian induced the Senate to depose Antony from the command of the East, and proceeded to attack him. A great naval battle at Actium in 31 BC was decided by the unexpected desertion of Cleopatra with 60 ships in the midst of the fight. It's quite impossible for us to decide now whether this was due to premeditated treachery or to the sudden whim of a charming woman. The departure of these ships threw the fleet of Antony into hopeless confusion, which was increased by the headlong flight of this model lover in pursuit. He went off in a swift galley after her, without informing his commanders. He left his followers to fight and die as they thought fit, and for a time they were incredulous that he'd gone. The subsequent encounter of the two lovers and their reconciliation is a matter for ironical speculation on the part of Plutarch. Octavian's net closed slowly round his rival. It's not improbable that there was some sort of understanding between Octavian and Cleopatra, as perhaps in the time of Julius Caesar there may have been between the queen and Antony. Antony gave way to much mournful posturing, varied by love scenes during this last stage of his little drama. For a time he posed as an imitator of the cynic Timon, as one who had lost all faith in mankind, though one may think that his deserted sailors at Actium had better reason for such an attitude. Finally he found himself and Cleopatra besieged by Octavian in Alexandria. There were some sallies and minor successes, and Antony was loud with challenges to Octavian to decide the matter by personal combat. Being led to believe that Cleopatra had committed suicide, this star of romance stabbed himself, but so ineffectually as to die lingeringly, and he was carried off to expire in her presence, 30 BC. Plutarch's account of Antony, which was derived very largely from witnesses who had seen and known him, describes him as of heroic mould. He's compared to the demigod Hercules, from whom indeed he claimed descent, and also to the Indian Bacchus. There's a disgusting but illuminating description of a scene in the Senate when he attempted to speak while drunk and was overtaken by one of the least dignified concomitants of intoxication. For a little while, Cleopatra still clung to life and perhaps to the hope that she might reduce Octavian to the same divine role that had already been played by Julius Caesar and Antony. She had an interview with Octavian in which she presented herself as beauty in distress and very lightly clad. But when it became manifest that Octavian lacked the godlike spark, and that his care for her comfort and welfare was dictated chiefly by his desire to exhibit her in a triumphal procession through the streets of Rome, she also committed suicide. An asp was smuggled to her past the Roman sentries, concealed in a basket of figs, and by its fangs she died. Octavian seems to have been almost entirely free from the divine aspirations of Julius Caesar and Antony. He was neither god nor romantic hero. He was a man. He was a man of far greater breadth and capacity than any other player in this last act of the Republican drama in Rome. All things considered, he was perhaps the best thing that could have happened to Rome at that time. He voluntarily resigned the extraordinary powers which he had held since 43, and, to quote his own words, handed over the Republic to the control of the Senate and the people of Rome. The old constitutional machinery was once more set in motion. The Senate, Assembly, and magistrates resumed their functions, and Octavian himself was hailed as the restorer of the Commonwealth and the champion of freedom. It wasn't so easy to determine what relation he himself, the actual master of the Roman world, should occupy towards this revived republic. His abdication, in any real sense of the word, would have simply thrown everything back into confusion. The interests of peace and order required that he should retain at least the substantial part of his authority, and this object was in fact accomplished, and the rule of the emperors founded in a manner which has no parallel in history.